Colonel Burini, Rail 9. We're talking about the King's African Rifles. Was it constituted in the same way that a British battalion was constituted?
I had four companies, and a specialist company. We were expected to learn Swahili, European officers, senior warrant officers, that were sergeants, co-sergeants in the CSN. All the soldiers were African, and then there would be African corporals, lance corporals, sergeants, and what they call WOPC, that's the warrant officers, the commanders, who were all junior in authority to their British counterparts. And the weapons were more or less, were exactly the same really as the British Army.
And pretty well equipped, were they? Were the reasonably well equipped?
They were well equipped. Oh yes, well equipped. In fact, when the man I started, of course, we became better equipped. Because we got the FN at the Stirling before the first half, 51, 52. It was Stens and Wrens and 303 rifles. Transport requirements, so we had ample transport. We had mortars. We had carriers, two-inch mortars. And what when we got them, what we say actually is cut the tails off and put a pair of boots on. And the only thing that ever, if an African died, the two surviving parts of his body would be his feet and his head. We cut the feet like leather, they didn't really need. In fact, it was only after a few years before I got there, during the war, that they started making wear boots, because until then they used to go out with puppies with bare feet. It wasn't all that long before I got there that they stopped using the tobacco on them as well. That was the line of it.
They would whip them as a punishment. They would be whipped as a punishment prior to you going.
That's right. They stopped.
What was the uniform that they wore?
Well, they used to wear KD shorts, jackets, two pockets, breast pockets, and what we used to call a jungle hat. You know, the hat they wore in the Burma.
The wide brim.
This side up, and the regimental colour background, red in the location for the green in the case of 4KL, with the Arabic figure. Arabic was something like that, 4. The Kenya, 3, which is what I joined eventually, was like that.
But the Arabic number?
The Arabic number. And you had KR on the shoulders as well, yes, and I had a red lanyard on the right shoulder.
Was there a lot of...
We wore the same.
Was a lot of rivalry between the various...
Battalions or tribes?
Tribes, whatever. You know, within the battalion? Or?
Well, yes. Not rivalry, but they used to stick together. I mean, we used to have things called ngombes, which were dancers. And you would find them all in their little tribal groups doing their own particular tribal dance. They would build a fire and give them a cow and they'd kill it and then cook the meat and dance and sing and drink and call pombe, which was a sort of local brew of beer brewed from maize. And it was pretty potent actually. And And they would amuse themselves virtually. And you'd come across a small group of Kipsigi, who used to do a lot of jumping. They get dressed up privately as well, and they put the red orc in their head and have it hanging down and get their spears out of the water. In fact, when they were talking about aiming a rifle, they would usually go through the motions of a bow and arrow, or to throwing something. Oh, and to get all these things out and have a drum, and you have about half a dozen groups, various parts of the camp site, all doing their little thing. That was really the only time that they separated into their tribal groups. Usually it was to try to keep them straight. Things like sport and that sort of thing, we always had the representation by company. There was company competitions or platoon competitions, irrespective of what tribe was there. You tended to find that Somalis, for instance, were usually the crack shots of the battalion. Some reason or other, but we didn't have many Somalis, so if you had one, you would automatically entered into the battalion rifle competition. It was just sort of some tribes did have abilities which were better than better at some things than their tribal colleagues.
A very wide recruiting area.
Oh yes, well, the whole of Kenya or Uganda. Yes. I mean, if you went on a safari, you would usually wear about 3 months.
Were they good material?
Yes, they were good military material. Yes, because they took to it. The discipline was natural to them. The hardship was natural. The pay to them was a fortune. It was rather unfortunate that we used to insist that they should learn English. When that meant really that they would have to explore the three languages, their own, Kiswahili, and English. And we would just learn Kiswahili. Didn't get excited if you couldn't speak fluently in Swahili to the soldiers, because they were expected to speak English. funnily enough, the company office was always in Swahili. And we always had an interpreter. Even if you could speak the Swahili fluently yourself, there was always an interpreter there.
I was going to say that it must have been hard on the one that couldn't speak English, but as you say, you had interpreters.
Well, there was interpreters, mm-hmm. Yeah. Just to make sure, especially on all of it, because it was essential that justice should be seen, and therefore you really had to understand what was going on. So there was no. The idea was that there was no chance of either side being misunderstood. But there wasn't always guaranteed that the interpreter knew exactly what he was doing. So it was still a bit of a mess.
Were you expected to learn the different tribal backgrounds? You know, you're coming at this situation. You've got tribal people coming in. Were you expected to learn their culture? You know, what was their their background?
No.
You just took them as they were, soldiers.
Took them as they were, and turned them into soldiers. First, I used to try and get to know as much as I could about them, because I think that's part of my management. But I did make a determination. In fact, I was lucky in my way, because I was when I got to 4K, I was the only English officer in the company. I was company commander as a captain, just before I came away from Berlin, actually. And I was sent for 6 weeks on part of the rifle range that was stationed in that routine, and I was sent up to a place called Wimbledon, which was the local rifle range about 50 miles away. And I spent the next 6 weeks up there with them, and they used to know me. They wouldn't speak to me in English, and unless I made some effort to learn Swahili. If I was trying to learn Swahili, they would explain what the Swahili word meant in English, but if I was just saying I was speaking English, I wouldn't talk to them anymore. So it was rather lonely at times. I liked them. These were the Ugandans. Most of them were very large in Uganda, big, black. I never ceased to be amused at one African soldier saying, "A black man over there." And after a while, of course, you appreciate it because he was blacker than himself. The other one that I was always using was getting sunburned. And I used to put Calamine lotion on their shoulders. They're white shoulders. And you never really expected them to get sunburned. Anyway.
What were you doing? What was the role of the regiment?
When I was just with the King's African Rifles in Kenya, it was training again, largely. Jungle training, drills, learning the language. And then that was 6 months of Nairobi, and then I went down to, we went down to Jinja. And when we got to Jinja, we had a much better camp. The Africans were actually in stone buildings, primitive, but they were stone. Whereas in Bashas up in Nairobi, the Oscar Smash was superb, absolutely superb, being built by the Ugandan government. I was living as a junior, as a, one of the junior officers, in a series of rondavels, metal rondavels. There was the dining rondavel, the bedroom rondavel, and the kitchen rondavel, and they were just connected by little passageways. And the bedroom rondavel had been put up, and there was a big African footprint on the ceiling where he stood on when it was down on the deck, you know. It was never removed. And when it was raining, as it often did in Uganda, it was much rainier and the wetter than Kenya. It was like being tied a drum, you know, you go like a bang, bang, bang on the raindrops on the roof. We spent the rest of our time at that rondavel, actually. Just before we moved from Kenya, I heard that the battalion was going to clear. Leicestershire man, yes, and he got the DSO with the Kenya, the Acton Rifles in Burma. I said, I've heard my battalion is going to Korea. I said, I'd like to, if you don't mind, like my CO, my old CO, and ask him if he can get me back. He said, well, if you want to do that, yes, fair enough.
Just before I move over on from there, very briefly, white officers and some NCOs, did they treat these Africans as soldiers, yes. Fellow soldiers?
Well, yes, yeah. But they treated soldiers. Yeah. They didn't have a very great respect for the intelligence. I think that was right because some of the sergeants were not very intelligent themselves, they were rich ones. But those that were thinking at all, you know, appreciated the qualities of the Africans, and also the fact that they were our soldiers, you know, who picked them up and did the training, and they were doing their best. Generally speaking, the relationships were pretty reasonable.
And it was a British Army regiment, in effect, was it?
Yes. Yeah.
So you then said you wanted to get back to the battalion,
yes,
that was leaving for
this. Yes, I asked him, you know, say it frankly, I didn't realise this was on the cards even, that I was very much like to be back and look up to go. Not last week, he got me back. Yeah. I think the Germans accepted me, of course.
Where did you join them?
Well, when I found out that I was going to be going back to them when I was in Jinja, and we packed up and we got the train from Jinja right through to Mombasa. And, right through to Nairobi. That's it. The volume was going, was cheap. We had a child then, Michael, and my eldest son, he'd been born in Nairobi. Volume was going on from Mombasa, from Nairobi to Mombasa to catch a ship to take her home. And I was flying up to from Eastleigh in Nairobi to Portside. But I had to stay for a few weeks before I actually got a plane or the IAF plane, which meant that Pauline was on her way by the time I flew. And she actually arrived 2 or 3 days after I got there. And what happened then was that the boat that she was on was going up to Cyprus to pick some people up. And then it was coming back So the voting troops on the ships that were deployed, I asked them, and said, yes, you can go ashore and we'll pick her up on the way back. So she came ashore. We were living in what we call a canal quarter, which was a marquee, which divided up into a bedroom, sitting there for as we were living and eating in the mess. And we spent 10 days and she went off. Ship came back. It was cold burning. She lost Michael, my son, several times during the voyage. When it was cold, he covered in soot. The place was absolutely black, terrible. But anyway, she went off home, and 2 days later, the battalion came through and joined at Port Said.
And which particular part of the battalion unit did you go into? Which unit or part of the battalion did you go into? Were you back to mortar officer?
Oh, mortar officer, yes. I've got back. And
had you met, was this the first time you'd met Peter Jeffries? And we've already talked about what he was like. And obviously you were welcomed back into the battalion. Had it changed very much whilst you'd been away?
One or two extra. I mean, the level of experience among the senior officers was completely different. I feel like Pat Donahue, Oscar McTwice, Sean Kelly, Reggie Atkinson. I mean, they were well experienced. Similarly, with the captains, one of the captains of FCs. I was senior, really, I suppose, just been joined up later. I didn't see any fighting during the war, but I was on the same vintage. I was about 30, then, 52, yes, 30.
And were you a captain with the battalion?
I was captain all the time. Admiral Boston,
And the mortar people who you were taking over, that would have been changes there. Must have been an intake of national servicemen that, well, maybe it's more than one intake,
well,
whilst you've been away with them. What were they like then as junior, as officers?
They were very good. Green as hell, you know. Yeah. I mean, they haven't really got a clue about very much, but they were very enthusiastic and very interested and very intelligent. You know, they were the same as soldiers. I mean, they weren't just one of the mill thick Geordies or anything like that. They were, Peter Jeffries, couldn't praise them enough. He was really thrilled with them, especially after the experience of being there and looking back on it. I suppose everybody was a little apprehensive as to how they would shape up, you know. But the point of fact is, actually,
yes, I was thinking that national servicemen, even then, wouldn't have been expected to go into a war situation. You know, it was a compulsory thing.
And didn't have much choice.
Yet they were okay.
They were very good. They were very good. And it was not very often, however, I imagine that there were people who national servicemen who said, well, there's Mike Micklewhite, that's from Kane. Mike Kane, he's got a bit of a book, which he was saying, in which he's saying, you know, I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. People actually shooting at me, you know, but there seems no reason why they should. It's got nothing to do with me, you know. I'd rather be at home. And I would imagine that quite a number of them felt like that. But, I personally had no experience whatsoever of any bolshiness or saying, you know, this gets stuff that I was sick of them. There was one occasion only when we were on 355 and the sergeant or sergeant Simon Templey, I think, he said, did you go over there with that chap? I went along and chatted with him, and he was feeling that way. Yeah, he was saying, I don't want to be here. I don't see any reason why I should be here. And I asked the sort of chap to have chatted with him for about an hour or so. I think it's happening perfectly. Certainly, as far as I was concerned, he didn't call it any questions.
Were there any reservists with you? People have been pulled back from the reserve list?
Not that I recall. I imagine there probably were some of them, but there weren't any bulk at all.
Yes, there was an extra 6 months put on, wasn't it?
Very few.
So it was essentially a national service battalion with a leavening of experienced officers and NCOs.
That's right.
And a good mix.
Most of the junior NCOs and privates, of course, were national service. They weren't really in long enough to be able to give them much more promotion. And most of them didn't stay on. Some did. Ted Wilson didn't, but he stayed on. One or two of the officers thought about it. Bob McGregor did, and did well. I think he was the only one that was actually really did stay out of the front transfer from the master service to regular.
When did Billiard join you?
I think Peter was regular.
And was he with you on the boat at this time?
No. He was too young when he actually died there. He spent his time as a Mercurial in the world and to come over. And Peter Jeffrey went before him when he arrived there. Had a chat with him and explained the laws of substance and capital, yes, but as soon as he used to let him know as soon as his birthday occurred, he could go over. In fact, I think he eventually arrived over about the last month or 6 weeks of the fighting war. But Bob was far as I remember, the only one that Bob was very grateful for, the only one that actually did.
He was national service at that time,
right,
because he did ultimately become a brigadier.
Yes, he did the other raid. We did two raids. One was a man called Perrott. He commanded the assault. And the other, that was Operation Blaine, and the other was Willington. And Bob McGregor did that one, but there was nobody there. He was supposed to be attacking us.
We'll come to that, of course. The journey then from, can we talk about the journey from Portsmouth?
Some of it, of course, once I joined, all the usual activities took place, boxing, shooting flaps and balloons on the sea. It had to be very good, you know. It was going up and down over the sea, so the ship was quite good, wasn't it? Whatever exercise we could get, we had a deck tennis knockout competition. There was bingo every day, dances in the evening. But there were women on the ship. There were mostly girls, ladies who were going out to, or families who were going out to join husbands in either one of the stations like Aden or Ceylon or Singapore or Hong Kong. And we shared them as we were going along. They were very nice places of women, actually.
Did that bring about any shipboard romances?
Yeah. I mean, almost inevitably. The two of us became friendly with her. It was quite a young girl. We actually took her ashore at Colombo, where she was meeting us. We hadn't done anything. We were just all friendly with her, because she was good company. And we got absolutely busy. She sort of pulled her away from her, and she never spoke to us again. But I can understand how he felt. He probably had experience himself of what shipboard excitement was.
The troops, were they pretty crammed? Were they uncomfortable quarters?
Yes. The soldiers were totally close to that. But we had inspections down there, and we'd see how they were and make sure that they were reasonably happy. I was responsible for what they were using, and I was responsible for my water people. I had to get them over anyway, because there were still one or two who had been with me when I was in Dortmund. mostly at that time they were regular senior NCOs, sergeant corporals. There weren't many of the National Service men at that time, actually, because they'd done their bit and gone home.
And these were still the 3-inch mortars of Second World War vintage.
There was lots of tubes. We were being briefed on, with the people had a model made, and we were really briefed on what the terrain was like. And, we didn't actually know precisely where we were going to be, but we had a rough idea of where we were going and what was called general appearance of the ground was. There was lots of other entertainment.
A canteen on board? There was a canteen on board?
Oh, yes.
The officers' accommodation, were you housed in?
We were in cabins.
Cabins.
The junior officers were used to share cabins when before them in the cabin. As you went up the scale, so you got a little bit more closer to, you know, plush, outside size. I can't remember very much about it. I can't even remember who I shared my cabin with.
And it's still quite a long journey from Portsett to, in your case.
It was another month from
Did you call in at various places?
Yes, whenever we did call in, we were offloaded and did a route march. We did a route march in Aden. That was a stinking hot. We did the same in Colombo. After we'd done the route march, we were allowed to go to the local officers' club and that sort of thing. They usually had places being made available to us. And if there was somebody like Hong Kong, the tennis area was the CSC there, we were all invited to his house for cocktails.
And he was a DLI man, wasn't he?
He was the Colonel Redmond, then. So we had red cocktails, and then after I went back with Sean Kelly at Donoghue. Sean and I, there was a chap that was the contractor to one of the regiments, was a chap called Shamshuddin, who had been the Tudia like contractor for years and years and years when they were in India before the war and then during the war. And he appeared up and he took us out and paid for everything. We went up to that sloping restaurant, you know, where you could go fish and up on the river. He paid for everything. On the off chance that we'd be sent back to Hong Kong, he would become our contractor. Never worked, never happened actually. Finished up in Egypt. Yes, so that was. We route marched in Aden, we route marched in Colombo. Colombo wasn't too bad, it was weather was quite reasonable there. Singapore was hot and sticky, and we went and had a drink in that part of the last evening. The Somerset Native, we were there, several of them came down and took us out. And then in Hong Kong, we went to areas, we did our march. And then we got Busan,